Just wave it over by Paul, not by me. You know, I'll be done.
That's right. It's all dependent on the kind of weekend I had. Morning. Open the Senate Revenue Committee for the last week in January. So we start out with school finance today with Steve Meyer. And we should pay close attention because I know we have a number of bills I've already spoken to, and I don't know if folks have come and talked to y'all. There's going to be several bills relating to the school funding formula, which are heading this way. And then the Oregon Business Council also has a couple of proposals around transportation and special ed, which all are affected by the school funding formula. So this is an area that I think we're actually going to get briefed on today and then come back to probably in a month or so. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Steve Meyer from the Legislative Revenue Office. I have way too many slides to go through with you this morning, so I'm going to skip and try to hit what I think are the more important ones for you, and hopefully this will just be a refresher course and not new information to you. So we'll go ahead and get started. If you would, skip ahead several, two or three pages. What I want to do this morning is emphasize process rather than numbers, so that you have an understanding of what's going on in terms of where the money comes from and how it gets distributed or shared among the school districts and the education service districts. Just a reminder that not all of the state school fund comes from the general fund, and the 0305 dynamic, 7% came from lottery. And the other 2% was education stability fund money for the most part. The point of this slide on the state school fund is to share that not all of the state school fund goes to school districts and ESDs. Some of it gets diverted. This current biennium, small high schools received $5 million out of the state school fund directly based upon weighted students. It did not go through the formula. And then there's also state special education programs that get funded out of the state school fund. So those are state programs for education at the deaf and blind school, at long-term care programs, and extended hospital stay programs. So some comes off the top, but not a lot. The rest then goes to school districts, including youth correction and detention education programs. That was put in to add those two and treat them as though they are many school districts within the system. And then to fund the equalization phase-in process. We won't get into the phase-in. We'll look at what it is in 05-06. That's the final year, and that will be the ongoing distribution process unless there's changes this session. Local revenue that's included in the formula is from these sources, property taxes collected. So if there's property taxes paid on a prior year but it's collected in the current year, that's included. Common school fund money, county school fund, federal force, state-managed county trust force, the Tillamook and Clatsop force, a little bit from ESDs, and we'll come back to that, and then a very minor, if any, dollars in lieu of property taxes. These are all mandatory payments. They existed prior to Measure 5 and the adoption of the formula. So they're all kind of lumped together under the label of local, even though they're not really all local, but they tend to be connected to the land, and that's a local connection. What isn't included here, perhaps, is just as important. There's no federal dollars here other than the federal forest. There's no donations, contributions, interest earnings, all those other kinds of sources, fees, charges, etc., that school districts have. But again, those existed prior to, but they're not that important, and it wasn't felt that those needed to be shared statewide, so they are excluded in the formula. Formula revenue, mostly property taxes, 93%. And then if you put the local and the state dollars together, you get the state school fund being about 68% of that total, property taxes 30%, other 2%. What we have seen in the last few years is that the state school fund percent has declined just a little bit. It started out being about 70%, versus 30 local. It stayed that way for quite a while, hovered around those two percentages, and now with the slower growth in the state school fund, the state portion has started to decline. Once we have the funds for the special programs taken kind of off of the top out of the state school fund, we have what's left of the state school fund, and then that can be put with local revenue from both school districts and ESDs to get the total size of the pie for allocation. Now, the next step is to then divide that up between the school districts and the ESDs, and that is now done in statute. Before the phase-in of the ESD equalization in 2001, that was put into the statute to phase up to 5% for ESDs, phase down to 95% for school districts. So in the appropriation bill, that doesn't have to be split out anymore between school districts and ESDs since that time. So that gives you the shares, and then if you want to get to the state school fund share, you have to subtract the local revenue for each of those. But the split is what's important, and that is ongoing.
Steve, on that, Gene, now, you know, there's going to be, the governor's got some ESD ideas or a bill in draft. I don't know if it's been dropped. Do you know traditionally, do those come to education or revenue in terms of their assignment?
Depends on the topic. They may go to education first and revenue second. That has happened.
Oh. So we deal with appropriations or the formula. Okay,
going then directly to the education formula. Let's skip what it's not about and talk about what it actually is. The formula for me defines what school district equity is. And if somebody asks me, well, do we have an equitable system? My response is yes, if you accept the formula as being the definition for equity. And what that formula does then is to try to measure the relative need of districts for available dollars given certain student characteristics, i.e. student weights, and perhaps a few district characteristics. And I think it's also helpful to keep in mind that the formula is kind of a product of the financial issues and the court decisions from the 80s. During the 80s, the major topic was property wealth per student being relatively, how do you equalize that among the various districts? And so that was at the forefront when the formula was put together. And then basically what has happened since then is legislative policy has refined what that equity definition is by modifications to the formula. And so it's not about adequacy, it's not about stability, it's not about all of those other topics that have kind of come to the forefront since 1991. Going back to the distribution principles that the formula was based on, there were four primary principles. These are not in statute. They were just kind of written down for the group that developed the formula as guidelines. The first was to share school funding sources statewide by allocating both state and local operating revenues. Second is to let each district decide how to spend its allocation. Don't give categorical grants. Give it all in a lump sum, at least the state aid portion that's sent out to the districts. Third was to adjust only for uncontrollable cost differences. So if they're basically controllable, then that's not as important to include in the formula. But if they're uncontrollable, like transportation or special education or facilities as one of the newer ones, then include those in the formula and try to have some justification as to why that should vary from district to district. Fourth is to avoid incentives to increase a district's allocation. Try to avoid a situation where a district is trying to maximize what it can get by perhaps putting students in one category versus another. And then also to set some limits where it's felt that it is appropriate. The cost factors that are included are these five. The first three are original to the formula. The high cost disability and new facility factors were added, and you see the dates there. Now, we then get to a general equalization formula as state and local revenue equals the sum of four grants, and each of those grants are calculated separately, a general purpose, transportation, high-cost disability, and facility. And so we'll put some detail with each of those grants as we move forward. The facility grant will start on the right and work to the left in terms of that list, both because of simplicity and the dollars involved. The facility grant is up to 8% of construction costs, and I say up to because there's a cap of $17.5 million for this grant over a biennium for 2 years. So you can't really be, the school district can't really be sure what it gets in the first year of a biennium from this grant because we still don't know what the costs, eligible costs are in the second year. And it cannot be used for construction. It's for new classroom space, whether it's new construction, additions, or portables, and it cannot include land. This came about after Measure 50 in 97, which changed what could be bonded and what could not be bonded in the way of construction. And so this is basically for classroom equipment and other more portable facilities. Desks, chairs, computers, that sort of thing. You can see that the grants have been relatively uneven, but the percent has to be the same for the biennium, for both years of the biennium. I said up to 8% because you can see that in the 01-03 biennium, it's only about 3%. So that cap has dropped the percentage way down from 8 to 3. So you have to lift that cap to get the percentage closer to 8%. The next grant is the high-cost disability grant. It equals the sum of eligible costs above $25,000 per disability student. This is the one that was adopted last session. There isn't a lot of data about it, but again, there's a limit of $12 million per year. What data I have seen so far will suggest that the eligible cost will be more than $12 million, so that instead of getting everything above $25,000, the district will probably get maybe 75% of that dollar amount above $25,000. So again, that will be prorated down because of the total limit imposed. This also sunsets at the end of 05, so I'm sure you'll see a bill to deal with this, whether it's extending the sunset or eliminating the sunset or something along that order. But there'll be better data, I think, later in the biennium or this year while the legislature is still in session to evaluate this grant.
So, Steve, on that, so the $12 million, there was a lot of discussion last session whether that $12 million would be a large enough pool to draw upon.
Correct.
And I don't know, it sounds like, I'm not sure if the data's in, but that was certainly, as we did the final high-cost disability grant, that was the big issue, was is that $12 million adequate? Do we know anything?
The preliminary data says that it will not be adequate to fund 100% of those eligible costs. But I've seen so far would indicate about 75%.
75%.
But that will change.
So $60 million, that could change, but $60 million right now looks like the number that would get you to 100%.
Right.
Mr. Chair, before we go any further on that, on the disability grants, I understand from at least some of the school districts I have that they got so many individuals that are above that percentage that we've set for what the state will pay. Has there been discussion before in revenue as to reassessing how many special needs students are coming through the different school districts, because it seems like there may be a disproportionate number, and wondering if that's been articulated in the formula for those school districts to be able to get additional relief if they're taking that much more burden.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that will come out in the testimony dealing with this grant.
Okay. Yeah, in some ways that was the rationale behind, you know, we did this and we did a transportation issue, and it's 2003 legislation, but the issue with the high-cost disability grant was just that, is that you had some districts, they tended to be where the hospitals were or medical facilities, mm-hmm. and they just had a greater proportion. And so the goal was, how do you better reimburse those districts that are drawing a higher proportion of high-cost disability? We set the $12 million 2 years ago, and at least to help drive some of that, and what we're hearing, obviously, is that we got partway there, but not all the way, perhaps, in terms of reimbursement.
The transportation grant is now equal to 70 to 90% of approved transportation costs. Before, it was 70% for all districts. The process now is to calculate transportation costs per student and then by district and then rank the districts from high to low. If the districts are in the top 10% of cost per student, then they get 90% of those costs included in the formula. If they're in the next 10%, 80%, and then the bottom 80% of districts remain at 70%. The transportation costs are for approved costs, and basically this is home to school, school to home, and then any transportation required as part of the education program. So if it's dealing with sports, it's not approved costs. If it's some other use other than field trips and cost in lieu of transportation, something to do with the education program directly, then it is included. You can see the growth in cost. I don't want to dwell on that. I'd rather go to the general purpose grant. This is the more complex grant. And what you see here is where the weighted students come into play, and we'll talk about the weights. You also have an amount of $4,500 that is adjusted by teacher experience and balanced available funds. We'll put some more meaning to that term later on. Right now, it's just a shorthand that doesn't convey too much in the way of information. Before we can weight students, we need to look at definitions for student numbers. ADM means average daily membership over the school year. ADMR is kindergarten weighted at 1/2. When we say ADM, we're usually talking about ADMR. Okay. The same with weighted students, ADMW. When we say ADMW, we're really talking about weighted or extended ADMW, the higher of the current year or the prior year ADMW. So we just have to keep that in mind, that we're not always real clear which of those numbers we're using, but more than likely it's ADMR for an extended ADMW. So keep that in mind. You don't always see the full notation. The weights then, individual education programs weighted at 2 times, or 1 for a regular student plus an extra 1 for a total of 2. Those are students that have IEP, sometimes they're referred to as IEP students. Poverty students have an extra weight of 1/4 for a total of 1 1/4. English language learners, you may know those students by a different term, whether English as a second language, or if you go further back, bilingual programs. All of the same group, only with different names, at a 1 1/2 weight. Pregnant and parenting at 2, and then neglected and delinquent and students in foster homes at 1.25. What is different about this group is that some of them are individual counts. The district identifies the student as a disability student and reports that to the department. Some are group counts, like poverty. It doesn't come from the school district. The school district isn't asked to say, well, student A is from a low-income family. That comes from census data for the district as a whole. So I have no way of knowing, or there's no way of knowing exactly which students then are identified that way. It's a group. Same for students in foster homes, for example. Some of that data comes from human services. And it's reported as a group. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Norris and Senator Rosansky.
Steve, is there any possibility that these can multiply? In other words, if you had a non-English student who was pregnant from a neglected or foster parent, because of the fact that they're not all on an individual case, but some of them are a unit, could they multiply where a person could be 3 or 4 times an average student?
Potentially possible, but there's a restriction in the statute that says the weight can't be more than, additional weight can't be more than two, but that only applies to the individual weights.
Right.
Not group weights.
That was my question. So it is possible.
Potentially, yes.
Could I have a follow-up on that? Yeah. Because one of the statements back here that we left was distribution principles avoid incentives. And I've always thought that there was a real incentive here to try to manipulate those numbers. Do you see enough abuse that it needs to be handled, or is it dealt with by the avoidance incentives to increase district allocation? Who makes that determination?
I think it depends upon the size of the group. Okay. And well, the later slide has that, but there is a limit on the IEP students. They cannot be more than 11% of the total students in the school district unless there's a waiver process gone through to get additional students above that 11%. So that's one of the limits that helps control that.
But just on that,
I want to just follow up on that, on the IEP. What if a school district has more than 11%? I mean, that seems to me that we're penalizing them because, for whatever reason, they've gotten that classification of students there. And if we're going to arbitrarily, I'm not sure why we would say that you can only have a group weight of 11% if the actual reality from that school district is 15%.
The state average is 13%. The 11% has not been changed since 91. That was about the state average at that time. And that, as far as I know, that's why it was set at 11%.
Okay.
And then the waiver process was felt that would be perhaps a better approach than just upping 11%.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And whether it is or not, I have to get feedback from the districts on that.
Okay. And then one follow-up, Senator George is finished.
Yes.
The students in foster homes, how did that designation come about?
Again, I think it has to deal with concentrations of those students tending to be concentrated in probably urban districts. I don't know the history.
Yeah.
But it was felt that group of students varied quite a bit as to what percent of the total students in a district they were and where they were at. And so that where they were located perhaps wasn't very controllable, at least on the school district's part. And so it was felt that some weight should be put in the formula for those.
And special needs or something? That's what I'm trying to figure out, is just because a child's in foster care, there's a belief that it's
they require extra services.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senator George?
Oh, I was just agreeing with that. Excuse me.
Well, Steve, just on that and on Senator George's question, how do we govern or audit? Does the department in some way referee the amount of students that are going into, because there's obviously, you have almost conflicting, you have a financial incentive for a district to go right up to that 11% on IEP and to get in every category they can here. And I guess who, do we have a rigorous auditing or to ensure that a student that is deemed IEP is truly IEP?
I think for IEP, yes, because there has to be a written program agreed upon between the school district and the parents, and so there's a lot of paperwork attached to that. And so I don't think, and there, most IEP students cost more than what the weight generates anyway, so mm-hmm. There isn't a incentive from that standpoint. I don't know if. How much in terms of the auditing process of the school district, there's the financial audit, and then there were some other items that had to be included as part of that audit, and I can't recall right now. I thought the weights was part of that, but I'd have to go back and check. This gives you an idea of number of students in each of the categories, poverty being the highest count, special education second. But then if you look at the dollar amounts generated, you can see that special education with a double weight and pregnant and parenting with a double weight generate the most funding for that weight. The other student cost weights. Kindergarten, of course, is at one half. There's still a few elementary districts and a Union High district that get weighted differently, with the belief that it costs more at the high school level than it does at the elementary level for those students. And then you have a whole system for remote small schools and small high schools, which varies the weight based upon the size of the school. And I'll just show you one graph. We have the qualifications there, but one graph will give you some idea of how much that additional weight is. In the shaded area at the top, if you go down and look at the school size on the bottom scale, and then go up from whatever that school size is, the vertical distance between those two lines is the added weight. So it phases out at about 350 student size small high school for four grades.
Did we sunset that, the small high school?
But you're thinking of the $5 million off the top of the state school fund that goes out to small high schools.
Mm-hmm.
This is weights in the formula for small schools, completely separate from that $5 million.
Okay, so we did the $5 million last session.
Yes.
And that was just a continuation of a policy, but no obligation to do that again this
correct
session.
Correct. And so this is a weighting approach within the formula to add additional student counts for the small high schools. And then you have a similar chart and conditions for elementary schools. I'm going to skip over those and then go to the student count table over time. This is just to point out that a relative size between extended ADMW and ADMR. Extended, of course, is higher, but it's growing faster primarily because of the growth in IEP students and English language learner students in those two categories. ADMW extended is about 25% more than ADM currently. Okay. Teacher experience adjustment. This is to give a little bit higher funding to districts that have teachers whose average experience is higher than the state average. And it's also then to reduce the funding a little bit for districts that are below that state average. And it's $25 per weighted student. So it shifts money a little bit towards the more experienced districts with the more experienced teachers to help with those costs, because they tend to be higher up on the salary scale, and that has not been changed since 91. I don't even think there's been a proposal to change it since 91.
Sure.
And since it hasn't changed, since it's remained at $25, its importance has declined over time. All right, now we can put some more information or detail to our general purpose grant. It equals our extended ADMW times a target of $4,500. Again, this is an entirely arbitrary number that was put in 91. At that time, the amount was below $4,500, and I felt that was a reasonable level to try to get to state funding for weighted student. That would be adjusted by our teacher experience factor of plus or minus $25 per year, and then times a balance ratio. The balance ratio is just to make the sum of the four grants in total equal the state and local dollars available, as we can see in the next slide. What I've done here is just replaced each of the grant names with a little bit of the detail that we've talked about. Now, at this point then, I guess it's time for a quiz, ungraded. Because this is, I think, a good point just to pause and do that, to think about what happens when state revenue goes up and everything else basically remains the same. Okay? If the appropriation is increased, what happens? As far as the formula and the numbers that you will see are concerned, the only thing that changes is the balance ratio. There's more funds to distribute. The grants can be a little bit higher. The grant that changes is the general purpose grant, because that's where the balance factor is. So every district benefits. Assume that state revenue stays the same, but one school district has a substantial increase in local revenue. Say there's a nuclear reactor built in that school district. Its local revenue increases rather dramatically, so the state and local total statewide is higher. Again, the grant, a grant or grants has to increase to keep things in balance. And again, the numbers you will see that would be in the general purpose grant, the balance ratio factor would increase because there's more funding available. But that then gives, since that ratio increases, that benefits every school district statewide in the general, from the general purpose grant. Now, if every district is benefiting, their local revenue hasn't increased, they have to get more state dollars. Where do those state dollars come from? They come from that district with the nuclear reactor. Because their local revenue is higher, their state dollars go down and get spread over the rest of the districts. Okay. So that's the way that local revenue, in effect, is shared statewide, even though the local revenue doesn't leave the school district.
Yes, Senator.
Steve, because the courts have ruled that we must have some sort of equality, that's about the only way it's possible to do it. I can't think of any other formula that would adjust that. I mean, because really you could have one district just run away from the rest of them because of some local development to greatly exceed that. So that formula is probably about the only way to actually bring the balance back in. Or you have a better
idea. I would hesitate to say the only way. It's one way, and it has worked.
Okay.
Any questions on this detail, I guess? Okay. But this is the heart of the formula, and if you understand this slide, then you have a very good grasp of what's going on.
And if you don't,
we have a run to get you.
I'm available for tutoring. Okay, if this slide just points out that the general purpose grant is over 95% of the total formula dollars, that shows you how important that grant is relative to the others, and I guess in turn the importance of the weighting system. Because that tells you how that general purpose grant gets divided up. I don't need to touch on that. What I want to point out on the formula of revenue over time is that you can see in the last two biennium we're kind of in an up-down situation in total dollars, formula dollars, as the state school fund has been adjusted in the second year of a biennium. That hasn't happened in the past, although we have had a down year in 93-94. So being down isn't new, but being up and then down and up and down again is a new pattern. And you can see the same thing on the next slide when those dollar amounts are converted to amounts for ADM or ADMW. You can see that the growth for ADMW is a little bit slower, primarily because weighted students grow faster than ADM. So that affects the amounts per student level. What's the next slide tries to show, and perhaps not very well, is that if the average here in 03-04 is about $5,300, how close are districts to that $5,300, either above it or below it? And what we see here is that a vast majority of the districts are within plus or minus $100 of that average. You have about 58% of the districts being within that plus or minus $100. If you go up to $200, I think it's about 80% of the districts are within that range. So fairly compact compared to what it was prior to 91. And that's perhaps more visible in the next slide. If you look at all of the districts, and I have limited to the districts above 500 ADM just to keep the scale under control. If you went back to 91, 92 and looked at it per weighted student, it would vary anywhere from 3,000 to, you know, above 9,000. Multiple of three difference. And now if when you see the 03, 04 line, the jagged horizontal line, it's within hundreds of dollars on a per weighted student basis, not thousands as it was. So that's the effect then after fully phasing in the equalization formula for school districts. The jagged part of that line, even on a per weighted student basis, is because of transportation being fairly different, at least on a per weighted student basis, or the facility grant, or the high cost disability grant, or the teacher experience. Those factors is what drive the differences per weighted student. Okay, if there's no questions, we'll move on to education service districts. I'm going to skip over the first couple of slides. You're pretty familiar with that. I did want to remind you about resolution services for ESDs. This was something that was, again, amended in 2001 with the phase-in legislation for ESD equalization. At least 90% of their state school fund dollars and their property tax dollars have to be approved by the resolution service process, and that requires a yes vote by two-thirds of the school districts that are members of that ESD, and those two-thirds of the districts have to have at least 50% of the average daily membership in the district. That's the mechanism for the school districts to have some say in what services ESD will be providing them with ESD dollars. That gives you the relative size of the state and local dollars. I'll just pass over that and get to the slide on general logic used in 2001. Basically, they decided that, yes, school districts provide services. ESDs provide services to school districts, and those costs are probably fairly related to school district costs, and since the equalization formula already has student weights to adjust for those costs, perhaps rather than reinventing a new formula for ESDs, the ESDs should just base their distribution on the formula used for school districts, okay, and be in proportion to that. And so let's skip that one. The way to do that then was to take that 95% of the pot, distribute it to the school districts, add that up for the school districts by ESD, and then take 5.263% of that school district total and say that's the amount that should go to the ESDs in both state and local dollars. The 5.263% comes from that percentage times 95% equals 5%. To get back to that original split between school districts and ESDs. So you're just dealing with that 95%, so you have to multiply it by more than 5% to get to that 5% total share.
So would that achieve, Steve, you know, we had the graph on the school funding formula where you had pre-91 today and, you know, that valley had become basically very, very close. Would we see the same thing with the disparities between like Multnomah ESD and I'm not sure which the one is in Eugene, but where there has been some great disparity?
Yes, we will. Beginning in 05-06, that's the final year of the phase-in process.
We'll see that.
Yes.
Almost.
It's gradually been collapsing around a dollar amount per weighted student across the state for all ESDs.
Okay.
So you'll only see the same variation in the school district in the ESD as the same as the school districts going forward.
Mm-hmm.
In this process, it was decided that ESDs, especially the small ESDs, should have at least $1 million available to them, even if their base was less than that. So there's some ESDs in Eastern Oregon that will qualify for the $1 million in 05-06.
Is that outside of the formula? So are you given $1 million and then the formula begins? Or
once you get through that first step of calculating the base revenue, that 5.263% would give some ESDs less than $1 million in total. So the next step is bring them up to that $1 million.
So if they're stuck at 850, that just gives them 150 and says,
right,
you're at a million.
Or you could have an ESD that has school districts with declining enrollment that are getting less funds. That would also mean the ESD dollars are decreasing.
Mm-hmm.
If it goes below that $1 million, it'll still be if the million calculation initially until it's the final step at least.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bring that base up to $1 million and you've already distributed your 5%, you have to make a final adjustment and say, all right, yeah, now we're over our 5% total, we have to apply a percentage to bring it down to 5%. So that's the percentage to balance. It's 99 point some percent, not quite 100, but close, to bring a few ESDs up to that $1 million minimum. And that percentage applies also to the ESDs that get $1 million, or have the $1 million calculation. So they get 99 point some percent of the $1 million in that process. That's been, I think, misunderstood in terms of, well, it says $1 million in the statute, but we're not getting our full $1 million. That's because of that balance percentage being applied to it. Okay, everything that we said about equity on school districts applies to ESDs. Again, it's going to change when the school formula changes. It's a policy choice, and it has changed in the past, and it will likely be changed in the future at some point. You can see the pattern for ESDs on the revenue side follows the same as for school districts, so I won't dwell on that. I would like to just move on to the local option property taxes unless there's an ESD question. Okay. For school districts, the local option property tax was passed in 1999, House Bill 2753 in that year. You've already had information about how the local option works in the property tax discussion, so I won't dwell on that. What I wanted to point out is that, remember, local revenue includes property taxes. So to not have the local option property taxes included in the formula as local revenue, there has to be an explicit exclusion from that formula, local revenue. And there is. It's limited either to the available gap, if that's the smaller amount, or it's limited to 15% of the formula revenue or $750 per student, whichever is the lower amount. Right. This was put into place to have some control over school districts that can pass a local option as to how much additional revenue they should be able to raise per student. Right. So this is another one of those limits as a control on the differences in funding between districts. And that's just a simple example. In most cases, it's the gap that still controls. As the state school fund and local revenue increase over time, the 15% will grow more than the $750. So the $750 will be probably the second limit rather than the 15% in the future. If you are interested in terms of what's happened to local option elections for school districts, this summarizes it. Voters haven't been real cooperative. Overall, since 1999, 37% of them have passed, 63% have failed. What's perhaps important to point out here is that you can see that most of them passed in 2000, or there was a chunk of them that passed in 2000. The local option for operating purposes can't be for more than 5 years. And that five-year period for those initial ones passed is coming to an end. And so those school districts are having to go back to their voters and ask for a renewal of their local option. Of the seven that passed in 2004, six of those were renewal elections for continuing their local option for 3, 5, whatever they asked voters to approve.
Do we know geographically where the, I guess, the 37% that are passing, is it dispersed throughout the state, or does it tend to be valley school districts that have passed their local options?
I haven't looked at it quite that way, but it is scattered.
It is.
There are some in eastern Oregon. I did a research report trying to look at some of that information. I have it by election, by year, by district kind of detail. What I found in that process is that the larger school districts and the smaller school districts tend to have a better passage rate than the middle-sized school districts.
Hmm.
Probably even a more important factor than that was that districts that had high property value per student were more likely to have it pass than districts with low property value per student, but also that a lot of districts that have low property value per student haven't tried to have an election, haven't gone to the voters, but it appears that the higher that value is, well, one, the lower the tax rate can be to raise the desired revenue, and two, the more likely voters are to pass it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I believe the one new one is in my district, Hood River School District, passed a local option levy in November.
And I think that was the first time.
Yeah, I think they're kind of opposite of what you said. They are kind of a middle-sized school district.
Mm-hmm. It's not exclusive, but just overall.
Yeah.
And looking at
just keeping you on your toes, Steve.
You said no middle, and
did I say no middle?
No. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Brzezinski.
And I also assume that the double majority is in play on those odd years where it's not going to the voters in a non-general election.
Correct. If it's a special election or a primary, yes. And I do have information on that, too, whether if it failed, did it fail because of low voter turnout and also a no vote, or did it just fail because of turnout and a yes vote?
Mm-hmm. Do you know offhand? Of those that failed, they failed because they passed, but they didn't get the 50% turnout.
I don't know offhand.
Or just roughly. No.
I won't guess at that. But that is in the report. Okay. The other point on the local option is that there is an equalization process for local option levies. I hesitate to even talk about this. There's only a handful of districts that qualify, 3 or 4. Again, backing up the statement that it's easier for wealthier districts to pass local options. Most of the districts that have passed them don't meet the qualification for equalization. What this does is try to give those districts that have the lower value property value per student to treat them the same as the district at the 75th percentile level of property value per student. It's saying for equal effort, for equal tax effort, you should have equal revenue, state and local revenue. Okay. So if your local revenue doesn't raise as much money from that rate, tax rate, as the 75th percentile district, then you are eligible for some state dollars, some state equalization dollars. These dollars are entirely separate from formula equalization dollars. This has nothing to do with formula dollars. It's a separate appropriation for this use only. And it's in the current budget, it's only $500,000 for 3 or 4 school districts.
Could we have a list of which districts are impacted by this, or let's say are impacted but have opportunities?
Let's see. I think I wrote those down, if I can find it. Pendleton, Colton, Oakland, and Sherman.
Do you have the figures of how much the incentive was for them to, the dollar amount?
I do not have that by district, no. Well, let's see. No, I don't. Not by district, but it, I can get that if you'd like to see it. Okay. I think that ends the local option, unless there's a question. Okay. Moving on then to the Education Stability Fund, which was formerly the Endowment Fund. Voters approved that change in 2002, and that allowed the legislature to use some principal out of the fund to distribute to the school districts. The revenue source is now 18% of net lottery earnings. That was an increase from 15%. There's a cap at 5% of the general fund. And the uses can also be for continuing education, workforce training, or pre-K education. It's not, or college. It's not limited to K-12, although that's what it's been used for so far. The withdrawal of principal from the fund requires meeting various criteria. There's four different combinations. All of them require at least a 3/5 yes vote by both chambers of the legislature. The economic one is to have at least two consecutive quarters of declining non-farm employment within the last 12 months. There are two budgetary triggers, whether the forecast is for the next biennium is at least 3% less than what current budget appropriations are. That's one possibility. The other is if the forecast is down 2% or more from the forecast used for the adopted budget. So that's two more for a total of three, and then the last is that the governor declares an emergency. And there isn't really any information as to what that emergency has to be about. Just presumably school finance, but if there's a declaration of an emergency and the legislature agrees, then there's access to the principal. The earnings currently go 75% to lottery bond debt service and 25% for scholarships, so that the earnings aren't accumulating with the principal. They are being used each year. So it's only the 18% that's added to the principal is increasing the principal. The management of the investment is done by the Oregon Investment Council, except for that 10% that goes into the Oregon Growth Account and is used for investments, I can never remember the term, venture capital type investments. That's managed differently. And then if the 5% cap was ever reached, although that's not very likely in the near future, that would be 10, 12 years out perhaps at best, assuming again that the lottery system does not change when I say that. But if that cap was ever met, then the 18% would be reduced to 15%, and it would go into the school capital matching subaccount, not into the stability fund. So that's the kind of an overflow mechanism. You can see from this table some numbers, and this is one of the few tables with numbers in it that I wanted to touch bases on. You can see the deposits will be $75 million a year in 05-07, again under the current lottery system. No changes to games. There's been two withdrawals, one in 02-03 of $262 million, and another currently being made in this fiscal year, 04-05, of about 122.7. At the end of 05, the balance will be about $33 million. There won't be much there. at the beginning of the next biennium, but with the additional deposits and with no withdrawals, current lottery system, the estimate is about $180 million at the end of that biennium.
Yeah.
Lottery Commission, Lottery Director will be here tomorrow to talk with you and about their proposal, but the estimate in the governor's budget, I think it's $203 million. It's slightly over $200 million, and it includes the governor's estimate to be $120 million in additional lottery revenue, 18% of which would go to the Stability Fund if those dollars are realized. So that'll increase those estimates.
And Paul, do you know, have we done an analysis of that $120 million? I feel that's a pretty aggressive estimate, but I don't know if we in LRO have looked at...
Mr. Chair, we haven't looked at that specifically, but if in discussions with Lottery and Director Penny, he'll address that tomorrow, but their explanation is that they don't see that $120 million as being strictly from line games.
Yeah.
They see it from a combination of policies that they think can generate that additional those additional dollars. So that's something we will be looking at over the next couple of months.
Yeah. Okay, then to wrap it up, looking at the 0507 biennium in terms of the governor's proposed budget, you have a state school fund of $5 billion, a local option equalization of $500,000. If you add the local revenue estimate to that, you get to $7.5 billion for the biennium. The school district share is $7.1 billion. The ESD share, $377 million. And the issues in this session, at least for the formula, will probably center around those various topics. And I'll stop there.
Thanks. Thank you, Steve. Questions or comments for Mr. Meyer?
Question.
Exactly.
What time does the tutoring begin?
Whenever you like.
Thank you.
We will. I think it's. We're going to spend time both on the ESD. I know that there's several proposals out there around the ESDs that I think. Look like they're going to start in the Senate, and so we'll be spending time on that. And then school finance formula, I think, will also, even more than we did at least last session, especially on the ESDs, but also on the finance formula. I think both of those will require a decent amount of committee work. And so, Steve, we'll keep you busy, and folks should avail themselves to any of the expertise in LRO or out there in the audience, because these are two areas that I think in about a month or so are going to become ripe for at least discussion. There's always strong opinions you'll find on the formula and on the ESDs. Senator George.
Steve, the other day we were looking on NEA's website and took the 11 Western states and analyzed them based upon our ranking. Those numbers are a couple years old, and they were indicating that we were number one. Where do you think we are right now with the downturn we've had relative to changes in the other 10 Western states? Any idea on if we've adjusted up or down? Well, we couldn't go up because we were number one. But
number one in what?
Number one in what category?
Total funding per student. That was probably been average daily attendance number two. I don't.
A different measure than what I'm used to seeing, I think.
Okay.
And again, it depends upon which year you pick because of our up down.
That was my question. Do you have any idea? I can get you those numbers. Let's take a look and see if we can maybe come up with where we are now.
That's going to have a significant impact on where that ranking number ends up, which year you're looking at.
Is your feeling that we have fallen below the average growth in funding of other states because of what I believe is, I mean, we're still number one in the lower 48 in unemployment, so that has to be affecting the amount of revenue we have that's distributed. Any just a feeling for it? Or
not a good feeling, but I would say, you know, we're probably dropping lower from wherever we are.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, I'll bring that to you and we'll take a look at it. Thanks.
Coffee.
Senator George, we do have a ranking on revenue per student that Steve's put together in the public finance pack, and that puts Oregon right in the middle, 25th.
Right.
At $8,600 per student, and that includes state, local, and federal dollars.
But that was not, that's all states, not 11 Western.
Well, that's 25th among all the states, but the chart has all the Western states.
Okay. I would wonder if that would be, because I didn't actually compare it with that. Thanks.
So that's available in your public finance packet and the school finance section.
Using that same major, I think that ranking of 25 that's shown there drops to something like 41.
Because of our financial.
Yes.
So the 25 becomes 41?
Yeah, and then it will probably go back up into the 20s and then drop back down.
Everything I've seen is that it's right in the middle.
The spread isn't all that great among the states on a per weighted or on a student average.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts or comments? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate, I know you've been busy, and I think you're... Unfortunately, or fortunately, it's probably going to continue. You're the West Wing of LRO. So that wraps us up for school finance tomorrow. We do have the lottery. We're going to have Dale Penn, and we might have a couple other folks discuss. You know, the two big issues facing the lottery are Wednesday's decision to go to line games and then whether the commission rates are factored in that decision. So we might have a couple other folks at least come and talk to us about their competing points of view, both online games and then the commission issue that the commission will adjudicate. And then that will basically wrap us up for our orientation. We're going to do a little bit on corporate income tax on Thursday, but we'll do... bills, hearings, and on bills on Wednesday and then again Thursday, and then just start right back up on the whole compliance and collections issue and spend most of the following week on that big issue of tax compliance and collections, which we discussed earlier. Thank you. Thank you to Senator Starr. I just had some of his bread, which is over there next to the coffee, and so appreciate the consideration. Thank you. We are adjourned.